She's the same wherever you go. She is the Mother of God. She's the universal life force. Satan is very good at accommodating whatever culture, whatever age, whatever clime you happen to be in. Making a difference to him. He's very good at accommodating it. What I simply mean by that is he'll make you feel comfortable wherever you live in accepting his religion.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Lake Oxford economist Martin Summers, author Gilad Atzmon, and me, Tony Gosling. US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visits NATO in Brussels, where he explains US tactics of economic warfare. Explains why China, Iran, and Russia are in the IMF and the Pentagon's sights now. The latest enemy. And with all this talk of the Irish border, how neutral really is the Irish Republic? Edward Horgan's a former major in the Irish Army who's been exposing the use of Shannon Airport for rendition flights. Rendition may be over, but Edward believes Obama's drone assassination policy now being carried out almost daily is far worse. And there are troop flights landing at Shannon almost every day. Ireland, the second unsinkable aircraft carrier. How can they be neutral? Plus the announcement of further charges against Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu, alleged to have bribed a news site to get favourable coverage for him and his wife. Also, Britain's state-sponsored child sexual abuse scandal rumbles on, with many of the VIP defiles potentially in the clear. While, in a shocking turn of events, those who take allegations to the police could find themselves in jail. We hear from a former Metropolitan Police detective who's getting increasingly concerned that survivors of child sex abuse are being character assassinated through changes in the criminal justice system. Our sister show Dialect is here at BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week we speak to Scott Ritter. We had a clip from the interview last week, a thorough look at his work as an Iraq weapons inspector and his view of the Middle East today. Also, a deep look at what's going on in the geopolitics of the world with the Russian-born filmmaker, philosopher, poet, author and writer Andrei Vilcek, who lives in Beirut. Listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. We start, though, Martin, with this visit by Steve Bannon to Brussels. This week, it absolutely seems as if these three countries, China, Russia and Iran, are most definitely in the sights of the Americans these days.
Well, a Russian senior Russian figure said the other week, we are preparing for a war. I think he's a diplomat. The other side are preparing we're preparing for war in general. They are preparing for a war. So it'd be very...
Which war is that?
Well, it would be very remiss of the political leadership in China, Russia or Iran not to be preparing for war with the West, since the West insists on banging the drum for having a war.
But it's not just the West, it's mainly the United States, surely.
The United States, it's the axis of evil, isn't it? It's the United States, Britain and Israel.
And surely the Americans are quite happy that the EU and Europe seems to be falling apart with all sorts of secession movements, etc. This benefits the Americans, doesn't it?
It does. And of course, you know, the current administration in the US is quite clear they want the breakup of the EU because they see it as a potential rival. And also, of course, a potential stepping stone to a rapprochement with Russia. So they're trying to get rid of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which the Germans are keen on having, which will give, you know, natural gas from Russia much cheaper to German industry. And they want to do everything they can to smash that, because they want the Germans to buy their more expensive liquefied national gas.
Now, Gilad, you were talking earlier about the bankers. Now, this is the IMF and the World Bank, and Steve Bannon this week is talking, the US Secretary of State, about using these banks as a weapon of war.
Now, before we get into Steve Bannon, because tomorrow actually I'm taking part in a conference about World War III and different aspects and possibilities, what this war is going to be, and my position is that World War III is already here. Mm-hmm. B, World War III is not a war across countries, but it is a war that split countries. It's a war that split countries. It's a war that split societies. The debate that you two had before, just 10 minutes ago, is a prime example. We saw it in the recent two elections in the United States, in the midterm and in the presidential. We see it in Paris tomorrow. We will see it in Paris tomorrow. The war is a war between nationalists, people who define themselves as bonded to soil and see themselves as one people, and identitarians who are cosmopolitan.
Hang on. That's
identities.
Not happening in Paris. I mean, no. What's happening in Paris is actually the old socialists are saying, we've had enough of this. Actually, what they're really protesting about is austerity, the fact that they don't have enough work, they don't have enough money to
Absolutely.
Feed their kids, to pay the rent, and all this sort of thing. Now, it's been very interesting to see, because Macron said, didn't he, that there was no way he was going to turn back this policy of increasing fuel taxes. And, of course, it's mostly diesel tax and car to drive around, that sort of tax. But these are energy taxes which go right across the society. Now, he said, I'm not going to go back on that, he said. Yeah. But actually, he went back on it. And now he's issued this challenge to the French people for tomorrow, saying, if you go out on the streets tomorrow, there's no excuse anymore. You're going to be
There will be war. Yeah. Now, I think that actually Paris is France is exactly this the same thing. There are people who are concerned with nationalist issues. All those taxes, new taxes that are put on the French.
I mean, this seems to be
people.
A confrontation. It seems to be very confrontational of a president to do this.
One minute. You know, it is not an identitarian battle. It's a battle that a nationalist battle that is unique to France. Well, now.
Look, hang on, because really, what's going on is you're right in some ways, but it's a battle about who's in charge. Is it the people or is it the president?
Fine. But this is a legitimate. This is a legitimate battle. This is the battle of politics. What I believe is, now I go back to your previous question, is that all those wars that we see between that, it's actually, as you said, it's Britain, the axis of evil, Britain, America, and Israel. I used to call them at the time BBS, Bush, Blair, Sharon. Now we have to change the initials. Are wars that are there to deviate or to divert the attention from the civil wars that we see in every Western society. This is a very crucial issue, and this is why the debate about the Brexit, for instance, is so confusing. Every piece of news is there to confuse us rather than to.
Well, let's go to Mike Pompeo now, because I was fascinated to hear that the first time I've ever heard a U.S. Secretary of State talking openly about the way that we will use economic warfare against these countries. Pompeo is Secretary of State. Let's have a listen to him now in Brussels a couple of days ago.
The World Bank and the IMF. The Trump administration is working to refocus these institutions on policies that promote economic prosperity, pushing to halt lending to nations that can already access global capital markets, countries like China, and pressing to reduce taxpayer handouts to development banks that are perfectly capable of raising private capital on their own. We're also taking leadership, real action, to stop rogue international courts like the International Criminal Court, from trampling on our sovereignty, your sovereignty, and all of our freedoms. The ICC's Office of the Prosecutor is trying to open an investigation into U.S. personnel in connection with the war in Afghanistan. We will take all necessary steps to protect our people, those of our NATO allies who fight alongside of us inside of Afghanistan, from unjust prosecution. Because we know if it can happen to our people, it can happen to yours too. It is a worthy question. Does the court continue to serve its original intended purpose? The first 2 years of the Trump administration demonstrate that President Trump is not undermining these institutions, nor is he abandoning American leadership. Quite the opposite. In the finest traditions of our great democracy, we are rallying the noble nations of the world to build a new liberal order that prevents war and achieves greater prosperity for all. We're supporting institutions that we believe can be improved. Institutions that work in American interests and yours, in service of our shared values. For example, here in Belgium, in 1973, banks from 15 countries formed SWIFT, developed common standards for cross-border payments, and it's now an integral part of our global financial infrastructure. SWIFT recently disconnected sanctioned Iranian banks from its platform because of the unacceptable risk they pose to the system as a whole. This is an excellent example of American leadership working alongside an international institution to act responsibly.
Well, I mean, the SWIFT system was set up by the Americans to make sure that they could basically pull the plug on it at any point, which is what they're doing. They blackballed the Iranians. And the International Criminal Court, of course, the United States isn't part of the International Criminal Court. They never signed up for it. Of course, Slobodan Milosevic and various minor dictators from Africa have been, some of them wrongly accused by the International Criminal Court. It's seen in the Third World as basically a puppet court of the Americans, and the Americans aren't even in it.
The evidence is Milosevic was actually poisoned by the court, killed by the court.
Well, killed by people around it, yeah. So in other words, this
in custody.
What's clear with what Pompeo is pushing there, don't forget that the rest of the world doesn't agree with putting sanctions back on Iran. This is just America and Israel. Nobody else agrees with this.
What about this extraordinary piece of news this week about the Huawei, the daughter of the founder of Huawei being arrested in Canada? Idea being that they want to.
Well, they're going after the Chinese ruling class as they go about their business, and it caused a lot of anger in China, obviously, and of course it caused the stock market to start going down. Trade war that he started. Do you know what's happened? The trade deficit has increased since he started the trade war, because trade wars don't in fact solve your trade problem, especially if you're running a massive budget deficit as they are. If you're going to run a budget deficit like that, you've got to have a trade deficit. It's part of the logic of what you're doing. So he's not going to get rid of the trade deficit by having a trade war. What he's doing is shaking the stock market like this, and suddenly it's going to break, isn't it?
Get back to this Huawei thing. So I think it's fascinating to see what that is about, because the Americans have been trying to persuade Huawei to give them some sort of security access to their various electronics devices. Obviously, they're a major mobile and telecommunications company, the biggest in China. And now the Chinese say, no, well, we're not going to give you security access to this. This is our intellectual property. And so they've kidnapped, effectively, arrested anyway, the daughter of the guy that founded the company in Canada.
Well, they've also, the fact is they're claiming that she's broken sanctions on Iran, which of course only the Americans are imposing. So they impose sanctions on Iran, and the Chinese entrepreneur is blamed for breaking sanctions on Iran, but we haven't got sanctions. So it's only you that's got sanctions.
So the Americans
on Iran
can arrest anybody that breaks sanctions that they impose. This is starting to get like gangster tactics, Gilad.
Yes, we spoke about it, and this is. The new world. This is the new world in which we are living. We see really law evaporating all the Western ethos, and for me, this is exactly the battle between Athens and Jerusalem. Leo Strauss introduced this idea to the West. He's not the guy whom I admired. He said that in the West, the Western culture Ethos is a battle between two schools of thought, between Athens, between the idea that is regarded, the city that is regarded as the birthplace of philosophy, of reason, where we think through, and Jerusalem, which is the city of revelation, where we follow law, order, commandment, mitzvot, as they call it. What we see is in the West, we are drifting away from thinking, from reason, from science, from ethics, and we have more and more rules that are actually, sadly enough, gangsters' rules.
Okay, let me give another example. Last weekend, Russia Today, a Russia TV spies, we're told by the Daily Mail, are caught at top secret UK army base. How the fake news team tried to infiltrate the British psychological warfare unit. Now, this sounds very Orwellian. It's like the fake news team are the Russians, not Brigade 77 inside.
What's happened there is an RT film crew went to the headquarters of Brigade 77, which we were told has been set up a couple of years ago. This is the British Army's psychological warfare unit. It's got 1,000 members in it, all of whom are officers. So they're all officers. So they must be paying a fortune for this. And I just read an article not long ago. They've virtually decamped 100% to Ukraine. They've virtually moved their whole headquarters to Ukraine, which suggests that they are planning something in Ukraine. But anyway, the TV crew just went to film outside it and say, this is it. This is where they do the stuff.
Well, the Daily Mail puts it in rather chilling terms. Steel yourself for this. Security cameras at the unit's base recorded Russian TV reporter Timur Siravtsev making passes of the highly sensitive facility as a cameraman filmed from a car.
Oh no, it's a TV cameraman? They're a TV station and they've got a cameraman? That's just appalling. What are they doing?
That RT are basically just doing what our media don't really seem to want to do, which is to ask questions about
unit? Why can't they go and stand outside the place and say, well, this is it, these are the people going in and out? It's a perfectly legitimate thing for them to do, isn't it?
What do you make of this kind of news story, Gillette? Because it actually made me laugh to read this.
I'm an immigrant, so I have kind of a transcendental a vision of the life in this country and the way it has been transforming over the last 20 years. And I think that whether you realize it or not, this country at the moment is unfortunately tyrannical. It reminds me all those stories of Russian immigrants told us when they came to Israel in the 70s. Simply, you look at the news and you don't understand what is the story, what they try to hide.
Okay, so is it just the Americans running the show here, telling us what to do?
No, I think that the Brits are quite good in being tyrannical, as Orwell actually predicted.
They're gangsters too.
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a listen to Mike Pompeo, not Steve Bannon, over in Brussels, where he really lays out U.S. foreign policy, which is I'm used to Secretary of State doing, not talking about the latest bits of the toolkit of the economic warfare brigade. But anyway, so this is what he has to say about China, Iran, and Russia.
Bad actors have exploited our lack of leadership for their own gain. This is the poisoned fruit of American retreat. President Trump is determined to reverse that. China's economic development did not lead to an embrace of democracy and regional stability. It led to more political repression and regional provocations. We welcomed China into the liberal order, but never policed its behavior. China has routinely exploited loopholes in the World Trade Organization rules, imposed market restrictions, forced technology transfers, and stolen intellectual property. And it knows that world opinion is powerless to stop its Orwellian human rights violations. Iran didn't join the Community of Nations after the nuclear deal was inked. It spread its newfound riches to terrorists and to dictators. Tehran holds multiple American hostages, and Bob Levinson has been missing there for 11 years. Iran has blatantly disregarded UN Security Council resolutions, lied to the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors about its nuclear program, and evaded UN sanctions. Just this past week, Iran test-fired a ballistic missile in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Earlier this year, Tehran used the U.S.-Iran Treaty of Amity to bring baseless claims against the United States,
before the International Court of Justice. Most all of this malign activity during the JCPOA. Russia. Russia hasn't embraced Western values of freedom and international cooperation. Rather, it has suppressed opposition voices and invaded the sovereign nations of Georgia and of Ukraine. Moscow has also deployed a military-grade nerve agent on foreign soil, right here in Europe, in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, to which it is a party. And as I'll detail later today, Russia has violated the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty for many years.
I mean, in a way, the Trump administration pulling out of the Intermediate Nuclear Weapons Treaty is one of the most serious things. But he's making a lot of accusations against these countries, really trying to build a case for these people, these countries being made total pariahs around the world.
Well, I mean, it's basically wall-to-wall war propaganda, isn't it? It's just war propaganda of the most cynical and frankly clumsy kind. I mean, there's no real case made there at all, is there?
Yeah, but he's references in, like a Security Council Revolution 2231, apparently says that Iran are not allowed to fire any ballistic missiles.
Iran is entitled to have missiles. Why aren't they entitled to have missiles?
Of course.
It's absurd to suggest otherwise.
This is what is amazing to see when you listen to Pompeo. You can understand why America is so frustrated with China. It's still a communist country, and it is a leading economy. It is leading technologically. It's actually way ahead of every Western country. Iran definitely must exercise its ballistic capability because it is under constant threat by America, Israel, and Britain. And Russia, there is no doubt that Putin, whether you like him or not, you'd agree with him or not, has managed to expel the Americans from the Middle East. Putin has won every battle he was pushed into. He's definitely a sophisticated leader. We don't have anything like that in the West. So it is very clear why a person like Pompeo or Trump are frustrated.
Would you say rattled? They're rattled by Putin. They're not getting their way anymore.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And they don't stand a chance because American elite, and unfortunately, as we can see in the last few weeks, or we know it for more than a while, our British elite are a bunch of intellectually, spiritually, and politically castrated characters who cannot lead countries and definitely not qualified to lead countries. And I think that what we will see in the West, we will see a new populist bunch of politicians that will come with a new voice.
You seem to me talking about this whole thing of imposter syndrome. I mean, it's been talked about quite a lot, this idea that you've got people in leadership positions who almost look as if they're looking from side to side, wondering what they're doing there.
It is very true. And actually, I cover this issue in my book about the post-political narrative. When we grew up 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, the politicians, as we understood it then, were there to fulfill our whims, that we had kind of a connection with the system. At a certain stage, we were reduced into consumers, and the role of the politician was very simple: to sustain consumption by means of credit. You are an economist, so you can say, we can decide whether I'm telling the truth or not. Now, this is
not
the situation.
Martin's
they are committed to Goldman Sachs. They are committed to global bankers. They are not committed to us as people. And this is a tragedy. And unfortunately, the labor is no different. But Corbyn is so popular because he is different. Because he is an old-fashioned leader. Bernie Sanders in America was popular because he is a kind of an old lefty, whether you agree with it or not. And for the same reason, Trump was so popular. What is so interesting to see is actually Bernie Sanders, Corbyn, and Trump have a lot in common, despite the fact that they don't agree politically on anything.
Okay, now, one of the problems of all of this is that we're finding increasing restrictions on what intellectuals and particularly university professors are allowed to say. We had an example of that we discussed last week on here. Kees van der Peel, who was the former head of international relations at Sussex University, was criticised for suggesting that the Israeli government, the Mossad, for example, was involved in some way in the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah.
And so I thought we'd have a little listen to him now. He was speaking on the Richie Allen show earlier last week, I think it was, when he spoke about the way that journalists are actually being censored nowadays. And he doesn't feel that the whole system of the media is really doing its job properly.
Both journalists and academics already in advance impose a measure of self-censorship which goes well beyond what the system, by its current rules, would still allow, you know? So there's probably even less critical material around these days, you know, never mind the courageous people who continue to write good stuff, but there's probably even less critical stuff around than would be possible if people were really testing the limits of what is still allowed. But nobody is encouraged to do that because it might cost you a whole year of work and only to find yourself rejected. So in that sense, we are in a very sorry situation. There are many negative developments both in journalism and in academia, which each have their own rules, of course. And these, the self-discipline is the most frightening at the moment, I find. You know, the way that people, that journalists, for instance, are forgetting about their colleague Julian Assange, who's holed up in this Ecuadorian embassy under terrible conditions. Nobody ever asks any longer what happened to Edward Snowden and so on and so forth. So the journalists are giving up their critical task because they want to survive in the current media environment, and the academics do the same. They are all becoming embedded academics. Again, let me always make the exception for the good people who are still somehow entrenching in small groups that continue to work, to do important work. But most of them are part of the ideological machine. Eisenhower already, President Eisenhower, in his famous farewell address of 1961, when he spoke of the military-industrial complex, he actually had, his speechwriters actually had proposed the title military-industrial academic complex, but in the end they dropped academic, not because the academics are not in large numbers recruited for this military-industrial enterprise, but because it wasn't snazzy enough to have such a long label.
And he also talked about specific problems for academics who criticize Israel.
Criticism of Israel is easily equated to denial that 6 million Jews, and in my mind actually more, were murdered in the Second World War by the Nazis and their accomplices. So you have to disentangle these things. People often forget that, for instance, on the eve of the invasion of Iraq by Blair and Bush, two-thirds of American Jews were against that adventure, in line with the general population, of course.
Yeah.
So you can see that any form of generalization is very dangerous. You should focus very clearly on the real forces that are at work, identify of whom you have the actual documentation, and then try to piece together how, in a very broad context, these forces have operated.
I actually looked into these topics extensively. We went through a big, very big change in the last 20 years, as we have been exploring in the last 2 hours, and yet academia was totally silent about it. The fact that we were reduced into consumers, that the political world changed, media was silent about it. And when you start to look into the mechanism that sustained this silence, you find out, obviously, that it has a lot to do with political correctness. What is political correctness? No one tries to understand what it is. Political correctness is basically politics that doesn't allow political opposition. Politics that doesn't allow political opposition is the definition of tyranny. This, when Pompeo is talking about China or Russia or Iran, political correctness is the thing that sustained American politics, British politics. Now,
because if you're thinking about this in parliamentary political terms, it's almost as if the opposition doesn't actually go for the weakest points of the government. It's more like a kind of controlled opposition.
Of course, control opposition is the next fragment that we must discuss. Just to finish this point about political correctness, in fact, is way more dangerous than tyranny. And the reason is, in tyranny, you are suppressed by an external element. So you know that you don't like Stalin or Hitler. But in a case of political correctness, it is a self-suppression. And there is, you are silent, but the next step, you just forget how to think appropriately. You learn to cheat to yourself.
Well, and this how about apathy?
This is exactly where we are now. This is exactly where we are. And because we are so apathetic, we can consume this BBC nonsense coverage.
Okay, the Saudis, he talks about Kees van der Peel as well, and the Israelis, he believes, were involved in the September the 11th attacks. Now, is that a legitimate point of view or a thought crime?
But to start with, every point of view is legitimate. The only criterion that we should uphold is whether you can substantiate what you are saying.
Well, let's see what Kees van der Peel's got to say.
Who commented that what should be investigated is not me, but the statement that I made, and that was a comment. Somebody accused Saudi Arabia of a number of things. Of course, as the bottom line, it's genocidal war in Yemen. And the whole list started with Saudis blew up the Twin Towers. And because I had just been reading some materials which made very clear that these were actually Israeli bomb experts who had been posing as artists working in the Twin Towers, who had prepared the demolition charges for the bringing down the towers. I replied, not Saudis, but Israelis with help from U.S. Zionists in the U.S. government blew up these towers. It was just a short correction. But that led to an explosion of pro-Israel groups who, to my amazement, didn't make any distinction between, let's say, Jewish people in general, Israeli people as a special category, and the current Israeli government, which is, in my view, the most far-right government the country has had, and who have a documented history of preparing all kind of terrorist activities, including a grand scheme on which they have worked for decades to let the U.S., as the head of a Western coalition, take over Israel's role as the war party in the Middle East. But I didn't spell out all these details. I just said the Twin Towers, which is one aspect of the whole 9/11 saga, were blown up by Israeli operatives, and that's a documented fact. It will take some time before that's generally accepted.
Well, as you know, Tony, we've been looking into this ever since it happened, from the virtually the moment it happened. I and you and others have been looking into it, and we've got a mountain of evidence now that suggests that what people are being told about what happened there is simply wrong. And the latest copper's hunch we all have on it, I think Mossad were very definitely involved, but also so were CIA, MI6. They didn't operate on their own. So these people are terrorist manipulators, and the Saudi connection is very important. Because, of course, it's everybody knows that Al-Qaeda was set up by Western intelligence services. Everybody's seen the Tom Cruise film where Charlie Wilson's war, and they go to Israel to pick up loads of Soviet bloc weapons, which are going to be transferred to the Mujahideen, Al-Qaeda, in Afghanistan, and everybody is all involved at that stage. And the story is that Al-Qaeda, which was set up by Western intelligence with the cooperation of Mossad, the Safari Club, suddenly went rogue and started attacking its founders. Rubbish. Al-Qaeda is a front organization for Western intelligence services, as the Russian general staff increasingly understand.
So are you a thought criminal, Gilad? Or do you think that Keith should be sacked from his job? Or apparently he's only an emeritus professor.
Of course not. I think that the reason that I came to live in this country is because I believe this country to be free, and it was free when I landed here 25 years ago. It is definitely not a free country. It is very depressing to see what is happening here, and far from being surprising, the elements that are the most suppressive here are actually Zionist. Interestingly enough, you are way more free to talk about all those issues in Tel Aviv than in London. Mm-hmm. Your audience will be surprised to hear that Haaretz and Ynet and other other Israeli papers are way more critical of Israel than the Guardian of Judea.
Now, Mandela's grandson has been visiting Israel this week, and he has said, that's Nelson Mandela's grandson, he says that Israel is the worst apartheid regime in the world. That's in, I think it's maybe even this morning's Jerusalem Post.
Yeah, in fact, I think that I'm saying it for years, and I get into a lot of trouble for saying it. I don't think that Israel...
So anyway, that illustrates your point, doesn't it?
Yeah, they're saying
it in the Jerusalem Post.
For sure,
but
for sure.
But you won't see that in the Times, for example.
For sure. And in fact, I think that for saying it, you are in a breach of the IHRA definition. Yeah, you can get penalized. But by the way, I don't think that that Israel is apartheid. I think that it's far worse, because apartheid is a racist system of exploitation. Israel is an ethnic cleanser. It wants the Palestinians gone, and as such, it actually reminds us a very vile regime that was operating in Europe
also
in the 30s.
Also, this week, police are recommending bribery charges against Netanyahu mm-hmm. in the telecom media case. Cops have urged indictments in the Bezek corruption probe for the prime minister and his wife. The owner and his wife, Netanyahu, downplays the bombshell. He says the timing is transparent. It was on the police chief's last day. So just before the chief of police leaves, he makes sure that he makes it absolutely clear he believes that the prime minister's criminal.
Yeah, I think that it is quite amazing to see it. Netanyahu is obviously not the first one. The Ehud Olmert, who was prime minister, spent some time in jail. President Katzav was in jail. He was a sex criminal. So this won't be new. It is quite interesting that the Israelis are actually indicting and charging their leaders. This is very interesting. However, I think that the case of Netanyahu is very interesting, because the more accusations are tossed in his directions, in his direction, and most indictments, the more popular he becomes.
Okay, let me just read out. It says, in a blistering accusation, police said the Prime Minister and his associates intervened in a blatant and ongoing manner, sometimes even daily, in the content published by the Walla News website, and also sought to influence the appointment of senior officials, editors and reporters via their contacts with Shaul and Iris Elovich. That is, he's the owner's wife. The main suspicion is that the Prime Minister took bribes and acted in a conflict of interest by intervening and acting in regulatory decisions that favoured the Eloviches and the Bezek Group, while at the same time directly and indirectly demanding interference with the content. I mean, this just sounds to me like the sort of gangster tactics. Actually, we used to get this from people like Peter Mandelson.
I think
journalists getting threatened in this country, saying, you write anything like that again, you'll be out of your job.
Of course, and you know, I think that Netanyahu may have something in common with Peter Mandelson, but I think that in order to understand what is happening there and why he is getting away with it, it is because Israel is not operating as a sovereign modern state. It is operating as a shtetl. What is a shtetl? It's operating as a Jewish ghetto, close community. It's now surrounded with walls. And Netanyahu doesn't operate as a prime minister. He sees himself as a king.
UN chief suggests deploying armed forces to protect the Palestinians from Israel. That's in the Middle East Monitor this week. The combination of prolonged military occupation, constant security threats, weak political institutions, and a deadlocked peace process provides for a protection challenge that is a highly complex politically, legally, and practically. Do you think that's feasible? Middle East Monitor say it may be.
I think that it is a necessity. I think that it is a necessity because we are dealing with a criminal state that has probably the longest record of human rights abuse. Whether this can happen with people like Pompeo and Teresa Jesuit Juif May in the Elm, it's not a clear question.
Will Netanyahu be phoning up the United Nations and saying, right, I want this guy sacked for bringing out this report?
By the way, I don't know if you saw it yesterday, there was a vote in the United Nations. Israel called for denouncing the Hamas, and they voted. It needed kind of 2/3, I think, in support, and they didn't manage to achieve it. But quite a lot of countries supported Israel. So I think that when we talk about Israel, we should never try to differentiate it with its satellite Jewish lobbies that are very, very domineering within the Western arena. And I'm talking about every Western state, Canada, America, France, Britain, of course, Germany, Italy even, and so on and so on.
Okay, so we've heard interesting bit of news this week. Albert Einstein's God Letter sells for $2.9 million in the BBC News. This is a handwritten letter by Albert Einstein, which he grapples with the concept of religion. But there's actually another. And this is my conspiracy theory mind here, going 19 to the dozen, because actually there's a much more interesting letter by Albert Einstein, and that is one where he actually accuses the nascent Israeli state of behaving like Nazis. What he says is that the conservative Zionist elements in the United States, several Americans of national repute, have lent their names to welcome his visit. Talking about the Israeli leader visiting America, it's inconceivable that those who oppose fascism throughout the world, if correctly informed, as in Mr. Begin's political, and that's where the end of the quote goes, but he's basically accusing the early Israelis of being fascists, Einstein. And
yeah,
if you search for the Einstein letter now, all you get is this most recent one.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. I would never. All right, I'm not a conspiracy guy. I would never think of be that innovative. But it is very, very interesting. Yeah, but I think.
What do you make of that Einstein letter?
The one that you just read. Yeah, I think that it is far from being surprising. He was telling the truth. As he saw it, and they had
I ought to actually quote, really. He says that the lest America be fooled by post-independence rhetoric, The Herat Party, Begin led, was, in quotes, closely akin to the Nazi and fascist parties.
Yeah, I think that he would definitely be kicked out from the Labour Party for saying it. because, as we discussed before, this is exactly what happened to Ken Livingstone. I think that the ideological association between Jewish paramilitaries bodies in Palestine in the 30s, in the 40s, and then early Israeli politics, the association with fascist ideology was clear to everyone. Zev Jabotinsky, who was their political mentor, was a clear admirer of Mussolini and some of his followers.
Look, I know you're not a religious Jew at all, right? But I'd love to get
I'm
your
not
take.
A Jew, okay, I'm not a Jew, I know. I'm not religious.
Well, so definitely neither of those. So, but I'd love to get your take on the Third Temple, because that's come up again in the last few weeks. The idea to recreate this Third Temple in Jerusalem is absolutely key, apparently, in some of the far right-wing religious Jews, and including Netanyahu, wants to make this happen. There's only one problem, of course. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is in the way.
It's in the way. It's a big problem. It is very clear to me and that the only people within this Zionist arena, Israeli arena, Israeli politics, who actually talk sense are those hardcore Zionist Third Temple enthusiasts. And it's not because I agree with them, obviously I'm not, but they are consistent and coherent. They know exactly what they want. They believe that they know how to achieve it, and big war is big global war is definitely the right path for it, and they are pushing for it.
And this could spark something between the Iranians and the
absolutely,
Israelis,
absolutely. And so, I thought about it today. Israel, it's just something kind of. I had an insight on the way here. Israel is obsessed with nuclear weapons. But Israel doesn't need nuclear weapons because its battle is a local battle with Palestinians. The only reason that sustains the need of nuclear weapons is a war with a country like Iran that is kind of 2,000 miles away. So actually Israel needs its nuclear its battle with Iran, and it invented this battle in order to sustain the relevance of its nuclear industry. We have to think like Israelis to understand it.
Marvelous moment of clarity.
Yeah.
More of those. More power to your elbow. Also, the big piece of news this week, the death of George H.W. Bush. And the Consortium News has actually put a pretty critical article about him, saying it was a case of Bush, CIA, and a case of state-sponsored terrorism. 42 years ago, a car bomb exploded in Washington, killing Chile's ex-foreign minister Orlando Letelier. In an act of terrorism, the CIA and its director George Bush tried to cover up. This is what Robert Parry, who died early this year, I think, covered in 2000. Martin, what do you make of this, not this particular story, but about George H.W. Bush's record? I know Webster Tarpley, actually, along with Anton Chaitkin, wrote a rather brilliant, and I would recommend it to anybody who really wants to get to know George H.W. Bush. It was called The Unauthorized Biography.
Well, he's been a long-term bad guy, and the Bush family are long-term bad guy people. And of course, the suspicion
Mike
is.
Mike Pompeo was talking about the bad guys. He was saying the bad guys are China.
Everybody says, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. We all play this game, don't we? But I mean, the fact is, it's quite sickening to see the elite in the US. You know, Clinton's there. They're all there going, oh, what a great guy H.W. Bush was. And he was a criminal. He carried out military coups. He assassinated people. He probably was involved in the assassination of Kennedy. He was certainly in Dallas on the day. And it looks like he was the operational commander of the hit. But we're all supposed to go, well, he was a great guy. Even Clinton, he was a Republican, but he was a great American. And just think, maybe Saddam Hussein was right. Weapons of mass destruction. It's the only way to deal with these people. That's a joke, by the way.
You know something about Bush.
Sorry, Gilad, I just want to get into the next piece. If you want to say something quickly about Bush, go for it.
No, I think that he's the last American president who really grew through the military, served in the army, was actually, I don't know if he was a hero, but he was definitely kind of rescued. And this is when you look at the first Gulf War, he managed to build a coalition. I'm obviously in total opposition to everything he did, but America really lost this capacity completely.
Okay, so next, our next story is to do with child sex abuse, VI paedophiles potentially in the clear. In a shocking turn of events, those who take allegations to the police could find themselves in jail. We hear tonight from John Wedger, former Metropolitan Police detective, who's getting concerned that survivors of child sex abuse are being character assassinated by changes to the criminal justice system.
If you take what we call the vetting system, so in the police service, if you start going to the very secure sort of jobs, and I did have one of them, you get vetted. So they will then go through all your personal circumstances, and they need to know everything about you. They need to know all your sexual partners. They need to know your medical history, even your financial history. So anything that's dirty can be used against you, i.e. blackmailed, because you're going to end up in compromised situations. And one of the things that was said to me was that, and this was said by a female sergeant, that quite a few officers that are homosexual, it's not political correctness or anything like that, and there's no way this is a homophobic rant, this is just what was said to me, fail the vetting because they could possibly be compromised due to their sexual history and the amount of sexual partners they've had. So if we look at that, then we take people like Ted Heath, and I've taken accounts of a couple of people now that remember Ted Heath from the day when he was just a parliamentarian, and he would cruise like the sort of gay hangouts for young men. So he would go, one of his favourite places was Jack Straw's Castle, the car park in Hampstead Heath, where he would go and pick up young boys that had come from the care homes. Now, he would have had, back then, Special Branch would have been made aware, you know, of what was going on, especially when he was moving up the political ladder, the hierarchy is. Then you would have started implementing protection officers. They would know what was going on. So this information would have been fed back into the system that this man is a bit of a loose cannon, and you know, what's going on with him. Yet he was allowed to hold the highest position of office, that being a prime minister, with such a monumental, checkered and perverted past, because he was procuring young boys for sex. Yet he was allowed to become a prime minister, and anyone who spoke out against it, we see what they do. They go out their way to absolutely destroy them. And what also we've seen, and I'm drawing a parallel with the way that I believe they knew a lot of this was going to come out well in advance, was the implementation of the 2003 Criminal Justice Act, which a section of it goes on about a person's bad character. Now, when someone years ago was in a Crown Court, they couldn't make any reference to their previous criminal history unless there were certain exemptions that applied, and they were very rare, and they needed a lot of preparation. It was called similar fact evidence, and it's now been superseded by this Bad Character Act. So the Bad Character Act didn't just involve someone's bad character criminally. They could use information from a care home, from a school, from an employer. So a lot of, like we mentioned, people that have been subject to horrendous abuse and sexual abuse in childhood, there is a propensity for them to then self-medicate either via alcohol or via drugs. And the drug of choice, pretty much still now, it was heroin. And, you know, in order to sustain a heroin addiction, usually you've got to take on criminal activity such as shoplifting or prostitution or whatever. So you end up, on the whole, getting caught, getting arrested for minor petty theft. But that is classed as dishonesty. So when you go before a court as a witness, you are straight away tarred with the label of being a man or a woman of dishonest character. So we're seeing this a lot with these victims that are coming forward with allegations. They're being demonised straight away. And they might be drug addicts, they might be thieves, they might have lied in the past. But under our fairness system, we've got to give everyone a chance. And, you know, anyone that makes allegations of that severe nature, you know, you've got to stand by them allegations. And there's so many sort of threshold tests, you know, and all the years of interviewing children and the many, many cases I've had, there was only one case where a kid was actually proved to be a liar. On the whole, people don't make these allegations up. There is no financial inducement for them that will ever be like a reparation for what they've been through.
That's a former Metropolitan Police Detective Constable DC John Wedger there. And we have some more from him next week as well, which is, goes into a bit more detail about his analysis of the whole Jimmy Savile case. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8 o'clock. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Bakawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour. That was I'm not quite sure it was in the first hour. But anyway, it was Israeli-born saxophonist right the way through the show and author Gilad Atzmon. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers too. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon. You'll find this week's show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Sky News Centre.